chicken and on finance. Willing the good of a nettle.
The dollar is down, the market's coming back, and nobody seems to care. Welcome, everybody, to Chuck and Ann on Finance, brought to you by IIE Financial. IIE Financial, willing the good of another. I am your host, Chuck Fulkerson, as we are hoping and wishing and just efforting spring to come in. I am joined by my much better half, Annie Fulkerson, here to enlighten us with big words. And for those of us with small minds, the big words can get scary.
Oh, I don't know about big words. We're going to keep it simple today.
You use big words. You many times will use words that have four, oftentimes five syllables.
Syllables.
You put the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yeah, we are starting to force spring a little bit. We're itching for it to come.
Oh, it's just killing me. Like I just want things to get warm and to get sunny. Warm and sunny together, they make for a happy day. I went mountain biking today. Mountain biking. So for those of you that have never been mountain biking, you might not think that there's good mountain biking in Houston. And you would be wrong. I was really surprised that there's a park called Lake Houston Park, just north of Houston, the northeast side. And went for, it was about 12 miles that I rode today with a friend of ours who's a priest at our local parish, Father Richard. He and I went for a nice 11 and a half mile bike ride, and he kicked my behind.
Yeah, he said, you know, I like to go mountain biking and keep it nice and easy.
Oh, and easy. Slow. Oh, I'm in pain.
Yeah. But you kept up. You said you had a great time.
Oh, I had a blast. It was, see, because I physically detest the gym. Like, if the gym were a human being, I might spit on it.
Oh.
Okay, would. I hate going to the gym. It's boring. I don't like working out.
Yet, to your credit, you do it every single day.
I do, you know, but It I don't like it, but I have to. I know I have to do it because
duty.
If I allowed myself, I would be on that show, like My 1,000-Pound Life or whatever it's called.
Like the people in WALL-E.
Yeah, I would be the dude in WALL-E who's sitting in a chair who needs a machine to come over and give him his extra large soda. It would just be one. And then watching the Olympics is interesting because you see all these high powered, amazing athletes, and I'm like, I could do that. No, I couldn't.
No,
I couldn't. So we will do what we do each and every week here on our show is we will talk about what the markets did. And, you know, the markets last week had a pretty big week. It was a strong week, and it was the best week of the year as the Dow and the S&P booked their sixth straight gain 6 days in a row. And really that led off of last Friday's huge market rally. There was a huge market rally last Friday, and there's a pretty good article in MarketWatch that kind of talks about this. The article is titled, Dow S&P 500 Books Six Straight Gain as Stocks Post Best Week in the Year, and the NASDAQ Lags. And it was just kind of going over what happened last week. And so for the week, you know, the markets drove up about 8%, I think, overall. It was a very strong week, but it was really spearheaded by what happened last Friday. And we've got to go back. And this is, I guess, now two Fridays ago. The market was down almost 1,000 points in the Dow Jones was down almost 1,000 points in the trading. And then it just like a rubber ball, boing, 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 it hit a bottom and it rallied back up. Now, I will tell you, I didn't really take a whole lot of stock in the belief of the movement until I saw it get above that 4 hour, you know, and I look at fairly small time frame charts just to give me some indication. And when we got back up above, call it 2725, 2700, that's really where I was afraid that we would get some resistance in there. And so that gave us a higher swing high, which started to show a little bit of bullish movements coming in there.
Yeah. And the economy just, or the market rather, kept rising six straight days in a row. And I think that had a lot to do with the continuing signs that the economy is growing, but not in any danger of overheating. A lot of people on Wednesday were waiting for the inflation numbers to come out.
Right.
And the inflation numbers were higher than expected, but only a little bit. And what a lot of the predictions were is that if inflation comes in higher than expected, we're going to have another reversal. And even though it came in a little bit higher than expected, it wasn't enough to cause any jitters in the market. Now, the VIX, which we had talked about last week, is higher than the average of all of last year, which was around 10, 11.
Yeah, but last year was ridiculous.
It was super low. And so I think we have a new norm in the VIX. Would you agree? I don't know.
Well, I don't know if it's going to be a long-term new norm in the VIX. I think that for now, it's going to be our normalization state. But I think we're going to settle back down, especially if this last move was just a blip on the radar and we continue right back the way we were, I think we'll see the VIX come right back down to where it was.
Yeah. And with the economy still growing, we're still having really good, you know, numbers in terms of jobs and also housing starts. There, it jumped almost 10% in January to an annual rate of 1.3 million, which, interestingly enough, is the second highest level since the 08 crash.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, housing starts definitely are, you know, housing is considered a leading indicator because of so many things that go into housing, right?
All the raw materials.
Raw materials, technology now at this point, right? Things like smart homes. And, you know, I was speaking to a friend who lives in LA, who's actually one of our IIE clients, and he's a friend of mine. And he was telling me he's in the construction field. And he said 100% of the homes being built are now smart homes. So that just shows you that that home building now has an effect on the technology sector where it never really has in the past.
And that's so interesting because we've talked about sectors before, and a lot of individual stocks that are in those sectors, and technology is one that really kind of overreaches into, it doesn't fit into any one silo, you know, any one sector very neatly. You know, there's so many different, like the Amazons, right? And a couple of the other FANG stocks, they're all in technology, right? But they touch a lot of different sectors.
Technically, Apple was moved over in the S&P 500 recently. It was moved over out of the technology sector and into the consumer discretionary sector. Okay. Yes. However, it still is part of like the sector-specific ETFs that one might use. Apple's still the largest technology stock in the sector-specific ETFs, many of them.
And when we look at the housing starts, the things that we would traditionally think of, you know, in terms of raw materials for building and things like that, now we have to look at different sectors because so many other things are going into new homes.
Right. And one of the things that was very common to use for new homes, and really as a leading indicator that would go along with new home sales, was copper. And copper really because of how much it was used as a raw material. So many times, and I've spoken to a number of people that use primarily copper as their leading indicator for what they think the market is going to do on a long-term scale. And that's because copper goes into so many different things. And copper has done nothing but go up on a weekly chart for the last year.
Well, that's sort of interesting, though, because like when we, 10 years ago, when we were up in Pittsburgh and we remodeled our bathroom, I was soldering.
No, but he used copper.
Well, I was soldering copper right. pipes, right? There were copper pipes in the wall, and there was a joint that I was soldering that was a transitionary piece from copper to PVC. But now, just last year, we had our bathroom remodeled, and I didn't do it this time. The contractors actually used a new, like, it wasn't PVC. I forget exactly what it was called. But it's basically like flex tubing. Do you remember what the name of it was?
I do not remember
what it was.
No.
But it wasn't your traditional, you know, PVC that you'd see in, you know, in walls anymore, because it had no joints. It was like clear flex tubing.
Right.
So that being said, if homes are starting to use synthetics instead
that's
of
true.
Copper,
that would lessen the use of
the
copper
demand.
As a leading indicator.
Right.
Well, and copper also, it's not just in the pipes and things like that, but it's also as a conductive element, because a lot of times it'll be used in production for technology as well.
Yeah.
So, and that's really where a lot
maybe
of times,
that's where the raw material shift is coming in then.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit, you know, a little bit later in the show about what does the dollar mean, and understanding the value of the dollar also helps affect that as well, because the value of the dollar overall will help affect the underlying cost of some of these raw materials. So, you know, there was some other, you know, economic news that came out last week that was all fairly bullish, not a whole lot, you know, for really people to be afraid of. And the European market also had a very strong week. European markets were up, Asian markets were up, although Asian markets were closed on Friday with the lunar holiday. But for the whole, as a whole, the equity markets were up around the world. Now, bond markets are starting to show, well, not starting to show, bond markets are showing weakness in price as yield is starting to rise. So I actually looked for a couple of clients to rotate out of bond markets and lead a little bit more into equity markets. Because I think as those bond markets start to sell off, you know, sure, maybe the yield is going to go up, but if the yield goes up and the price goes down more than you're returning in the yield, do you really want to be in that thing overall? So you've got to understand, what's my mix? What's my blend? Should I have a blend of stocks and bonds and commodities? And if I do have a blend of stocks and bonds and commodities, what does the perfect blend look like? And how do I set up my portfolio? Every one of us are little unique snowflakes, I like to say. And as a unique little snowflake, we all need our own plan. If you don't have a plan, if you don't know what your plan is, give the offices a call, 832-953-4998. That's 832-953-4998. And we can help you work through a plan that fits your needs. Let's talk about our news headlines of the week. Each and every week, we like to take a look at some headlines that maybe are dominating the stories, pull them out, and, you know, dissect them a little bit.
Yeah, we always get good ones.
I love to dissect these. And by the way, if you guys ever have any stories that you want us to review or any stories you want us to look at, feel free to add them to our Twitter page, at IIE Financial on Twitter, or just send me an email, chuck@IIEfinancial.com. If you got some stories that you'd like us to elaborate on and give us our thoughts, opinions, and feedback. So we like to start always with the news of the weird. So our news of the weird this week is centered around something unique that happened in the Winter Olympics. Did you hear about this?
I did. I love this story.
So
I think it's hilarious.
Now here's why I find this to be amazing.
Disrespectfully hilarious, but
hilarious. Nonetheless. So imagine, if you would, that you are in South Korea at the Olympics. Right, you're in South Korea at the Olympics, and there is absolutely no question about who the one person South Koreans have the most worry. Like, if you asked South Korean moms who they worry about, who would it be? The North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un. So what would it be if at the South Korean Olympics, Kim Jong-un just showed up? But he didn't just show up alone. He showed up with Donald Trump, and they were shaking hands. What would that do?
Scandalous.
It's scandalous. It's amazing. Scandalous. So at the opening ceremonies, Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump were there together, shaking hands, saying kumbaya. Oh, but they were impersonators.
Yeah, they were.
But seriously,
and they were escorted out of the opening ceremonies.
They were escorted out of the opening ceremonies. But here's what's great. So this is from SBS News, which is an Australian news agency. Kim Jong-un impersonator is an Australian man.
Named Howard.
And his name is Howard.
Apparently he's been impersonating Kim Jong-un since 2013. This is not like a new thing.
When I think of the name Howard, I don't think of South Korean dictator.
Yeah, he was interviewed and he's got, I guess, Chinese heritage. And so he decided that he would be a professional impersonator, and so he impersonates Kim Jong-un. And he, in the Olympics, they were escorted, he and the man impersonating President Trump were escorted out of the opening ceremonies, but then it wasn't long before they reappeared, and Howard walked by the North Korean cheerleaders
at a hockey game.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple things in here I'd like to talk about. First of all, North Korea has a hockey team? Let's start there.
Actually, North Korea has cheerleaders.
Let's go next. Do they have cheerleaders at a hockey game? I've been to a lot of hockey games. I don't see a lot of cheerleaders. Third is that he walked by the cheerleaders. Now, they were, open quote, shocked and surprised, and some of them even laughed. But the North Korean minders did not find it funny. North Korean minders, I think, are the they're kind of the people that follow around all the North Korean athletes to make sure they don't defect. He said, unfortunately, they did not have a sense of humor.
Well, I guess when I was reading a little bit more about this, apparently it's considered actual blasphemy to impersonate a member of the royal family of North Korea.
Whatever. But I think that it's hilarious. And, you know, the Olympics are going on. It's still a big deal at the, you know, no U.S. leading in much of the medal count, I think.
Norway's leading.
Oh,
Norway always.
The Vikings always win. Seriously, these people are Vikings for a reason.
they're dominating. As we're recording this today on February 18th, they're leading with, I think, 31 medals total.
Yeah. Lots of Svedsons and Heinrichs and
I think the U.S. is like fourth with like 11 medals or something.
Sixth, actually, with 10 medals. We are behind the Olympic athletes from Russia.
I know. You know, I find that so odd. Like, Russia's been banned from participating, and yet, like, why not just call them independent athletes?
I don't know. Like, but they're Olympic athlete from Russia.
You might as well just call them Russian athletes. I mean, I don't understand they put the Olympic rings up instead of the flag. It just doesn't really make sense.
Olympic athletes from Russia.
I don't know.
Well,
kind of weird. I love to watch the Olympics.
I enjoy seeing countries like Kazakhstan that have one bronze medal. Even Spain has two bronze medals. I don't think of Spain as a Winter Olympics kind of place, do you?
No, but you know what's interesting, though? Like, we were listening to, what were we watching? Freestyle skiing and the men's last night. And one of the guys that is competing for the United States could have competed for Italy, which the announcers mentioned would have been a much easier time for him to just walk on to the Italian freestyle skiing team.
Right.
Based on his mother's heritage, but he really wanted to compete for the United States. So I guess that's not something that I've really thought of before. You know, like, people can live here, they're born here, but they can compete for another country as long as their family heritage, you know, allows that. And it's easier for them to walk onto another team than it is for them to actually compete for the country that they were born in.
Well, yeah. Know? Yeah, because you could identify as an Italian.
I guess so.
Well, you know.
I guess as long as you identify as something, it's all right.
I speak Italian. I got a mustache. Bop-a-da-boopy. Bop-a-da-boppy. All right. So
and you can only say that because you're sitting across the table from an Italian.
Yeah, that's all I can say. All right, so let's get into a couple of other headlines. Headline on investing.com, and this was a headline from February 16th. Investing.com says U.S. consumer sentiment hit second highest level since 2004. So the U.S. consumer sentiment hitting its second highest, biggest, most bullish level since the year 2004. Now, we remember back to 2004, that was really 3 years of a basically straight up market movement with those consumer sentiment numbers that were very strong. Now, consumer sentiment really I guess it would be the confidence of the buyers, right? The confidence of the buyers, and really the stock market gyrations have been dominated by rising incomes, unemployment growth, and a net favorable perception of the tax reforms, interestingly enough. So as much as there was mass media screaming from the hills about this tax reform taking money out of people's pockets, consumer sentiment does not agree with that. It's actually saying, consumer sentiment is saying, that there's a favorable perception of tax reforms. And
just a clarification. I think by mistake you said unemployment growth.
Oh, I meant to say
unemployment.
Employment growth. Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, it's interesting because if you turn on the mass media, all you hear about is blood in the streets when it comes to taxes and government regulations and what quote unquote the man is doing. Yet when you look at what consumer sentiment is saying, what the market is telling us, what's really happening, and look at the facts, it's a completely different story. And that's one of the things about mass media that I think a lot of people get caught up in the hype that is the media engine, and forgetting that media engines are always going to have their own agenda and their own bias.
And that's driven by the almighty dollar.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the dollar is really what's going to move most of their decision-making, and it's going to be where can they sell advertising, mm-hmm. right? Where can they sell advertising? And so, you know, a lot of times the key for us to look at is what do the numbers tell us? And the numbers tell us that consumer sentiment hit its second lowest level since 2004. The data signal is an expected gain of 2.9% in real personal consumption expenditures during 2018. So 2.9% in expenditures would outpace inflation at this point. So if expenditures outpace inflation, that becomes an additional bump. What you don't want to see is inflation outpacing spending, because if inflation outpaces spending, now what you're going to have is you're going to have this widening gap between prices and spending. And if spending slows down because prices get too high, then what you see is that's where the lack of productivity then comes into play. I mean, think about anything. When you look at any economy, it's driven by spending, production, and manufacturing, right? Jobs, essentially. Jobs, spending, and production, which is manufacturing. And those three things all have to be working in harmony. And with unemployment where it is, combined with this high consumer sentiment number, there's nothing that really says from a fundamental basis, the little blip that we saw in the market last week, that that's going to continue. We see that that actually has a better chance to be over and for prices to continue to rally up to essentially record highs. And those record highs in the markets, there's really no overhead stopping. The volatility index is sitting at 19, so it's gone down a little bit, and the market has continued to rally up. Now, we are still not back to our all-time high. We won't know for sure until we get back to that all-time high, but having this consumer sentiment number hitting its second highest level since 2004 is a very strong bullish indication. And this is why, you know, we talk about it on every show. We talk about it every time that we do. You have to have a plan. The plan that you have in place is what's going to help you make sure that you have, a place to go when the market shifts directions. If you don't have a plan, if you don't know what your plan is, go online, go to IIEfinancial.com, go to the Contact Us section, fill some information out, and we'd love to talk to you and help you design the plan that makes sense for you. So let's talk a little bit about our education segment for the week. You know, we each week want to do a little piece about edumacation to get our learn on, if you say. Now, when we talk about education, you are a teacher. You teach the youth of America.
I do.
Our young people. You teach financial literacy to high schoolers, and then you homeschool our children, and then you also teach for the church, and you teach at a homeschool co-op group.
Mm-hmm.
How do you stay awake ever?
Loads of caffeine.
That's awesome.
And lots of working out.
Okay. Because I have to tell you, when I see what your days consist of, and all of the teaching that you do to kids, it's impressive.
Well, thanks.
And then we come on this show, and we do some more learning.
We do.
It's our learn-on session. So in this section, we're going to talk today about the dollar. People are like, well, who cares? It's the dollar. What is the dollar? What does it matter, right? So think about, we're going to talk about currency and why currency is important, but specifically the dollar. We've talked about foreign currency before on the show and why people look at foreign currencies, what they mean, what they matter. But, you know, that glass of wine that you're about to drink, what did we buy that with?
Cheers.
Yeah.
U.S. dollars.
We bought it with U.S. dollars, right? Everything that we buy with U.S. dollars. Now, that glass of wine that you're about to drink is gulp. I think that is an Italian wine, if I'm not mistaken. So that's an Italian wine. Now, the people in Italy that made the grapes, they sold that wine, not in dollars, but in euros.
In euros.
So the conversion of the dollar to euros is a pretty important piece. But more importantly than that, here's really where it comes down to.
And just allow me to interject, because every time we are exceptional market timers. You know why? Do you?
Every time that we go to Europe, the dollar is terrible.
That's right. We can time the market because we always schedule our trips when the dollar is at the absolute lowest point.
Oh, we did too. It was the worst. We went to Europe during the literally, not figuratively, literally the single worst day an American could go to Europe in terms of monetary policy. I think there's a lot of worse days that an American could have went
just
to
in
Europe.
In terms of monetary policy.
But in terms of the monetary value of the dollar, we went on literally the absolute worst day because we bought less and less stuff with the money that we had in our hands.
Yeah.
But you know, the reason that I bring the dollar up is not so much about currency conversion, right? Because if you're going to go on vacation to Mexico, and the strength of the dollar will dictate how many pesos you can get for your dollar. It'll also dictate it where you go, right? Because different places are going to have different exchange rates. But more importantly than that, when the company in Italy that makes your wine, or any company, when they want to use oil, right? So let's say that there's a Swedish company, and that Swedish company wants to buy oil. That's, you know, the Swedish krona is the currency of the unit of currency. What do they buy oil in? Dollars. When you go to Great Britain and companies in the Great British Pound want to buy oil, what do they buy oil in?
Dollars.
When the Bank of Japan wants to buy gold as a hedge to all of the funds that they have, what do they buy gold in? Dollars. Now, why is that? That's because the dollar is known as what's called the world reserve currency. Now, the world reserve currency means that the futures contracts for major commodities are traded in one currency, and that is to create a level and a fair playing field. Now, why is the U.S. dollar the world reserve currency? Well, because when the world reserve currency is selected, it typically goes to the strongest economy at the time. And before it was the dollar, it was the Great British Pound. Now, why did the pound lose its world reserve currency status? Well, because after World War II, when England was basically repairing their country, they started blindly printing money, causing hyperinflation, essentially, in order to finance the repair of the infrastructure of the country that had been bombed. It's really what it comes down to. So when they have this hyperinflation and the printing of money for no essential reason, it was essential to get it done. But the point is that when you've got that much currency manipulation, the rest of the world steps in and says, whoa, this doesn't make sense that this is our reserve currency. So the currency was moved over to the dollar. Now, what does that mean for us? Well, what that means for us is that the value of the dollar, where the dollar sits in relation to the world's other currencies, is important, because the lower the dollar goes, meaning that as the dollar drops in value, it's going to cost more dollars to buy the same stuff, which will have the effect of raising the price of said stuff that is measured in dollars. So, good example, oil and gold. Both oil and gold have rallied in price over the last few weeks, right? As oil and gold have rallied in price, people are talking about, oh, oil's going up. The demand is getting higher. Gold's getting higher. Are they getting higher or is the dollar getting lower? See, when you combine those two together, that really tells a better story. So you can't just look at the price of oil or at the price of gold. You've got to look at the underlying movement of the dollar, and that dollar's underlying movement is what's going to be the main influencing factor on the price of those commodities, which are in fact traded in dollars.
So what is an investor to do?
So as an investor, the first thing that I would say to do is to understand the value of the dollar and where it's going. And if the dollar looks like it's going to continue to fall, that means we're going to have higher inflation, and it means that our raw material commodity costs are going to go up. So as an investor, what you can do is you can look at investment opportunities in raw material commodities if indeed you think the dollar is going to continue to lose value. Now, we know that the dollar is going to continue to lose value because it's the goal of the administration to weaken the dollar. How do you weaken the dollar? The way you weaken the dollar is by causing inflation through the increase of interest rates. By increasing interest rates, you decrease the world's demand for the dollar, thus increasing the availability of supply, which lowers the value.
Right. And the idea behind that is to stimulate exports, right?
Right. And the whole idea for that is to stimulate exports. Because if you're in Europe and stuff, it costs less money, then it stimulates the exports and makes more things happen, if you will, from a production standpoint in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. That's not just like this ideological type thing. Like, we saw this several years ago. Remember when we were up in New York, right? We were walking around Manhattan, right, and ran into a couple of women from London, and it was cheaper for them to fly to New York to go shopping and then fly home than it was to buy those same goods in their own country.
Now, to be fair, they were doing a pretty big shopping trip.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, this was not like to go for six oranges. I mean, they came with a very specific set of items in mind, and they were high-priced items. But that being said, they could have bought those items in pounds.
Right.
But instead, they flew to the United States.
They convert those pounds over to dollars, and they mm-hmm. essentially at the time were getting 2-1.
Right.
So for every pound, they were getting $2. And so the items they were buying were significantly less expensive for them mm-hmm. because, you know, what might be 24 pounds in the UK, they would come here and it would be $30. Well, for their 24 pounds, they would come to the US and get $48. And what was 24 pounds in the UK is $30 in the US. They make out $18 in the good, which turns out to be about 9 pounds based on the conversion rate.
Right.
And so what happens is that's just international trade. But as an investor who's domiciled here in the States, the way that they can take advantage of it is by utilizing ETFs, exchange traded funds, that mirror the price of commodities. So ETFs like GLD is gold, SLV is silver, USO is mirrors the price of oil, essentially. Or they could use currency ETFs. So maybe you think that the euro is going to be very strong as the dollar shows weakness. Something like FXE could be an example. Now, these are all just examples, and in no way should you run out and just go blindly buy these. These are not, I'm not saying that I am not saying that at all. What I am saying is that these may become alternative investments that will rally in price as the dollar continues to fall, typically. Right? It's not there is nothing that's ever 100% certainty when it comes to the market, but this is as close to, I don't want to say certainty, this is as close to a law that the market has, right? When what you buy in dollars, as the dollar goes down in value, it will more often than not go up in value. So all the stuff about the demand and the supply and who's pumping what and who's printing what and who's doing it, what I care about is the people that that are buying these products, when the currency unit that they're buying them in is going to change, that's what will affect the price.
And the nice thing about the ETFs is that they're very, very low cost. You're in and out for $4 or $5, you know, in and out of these. And then you can do it throughout the day in real-time prices. So in order to, you know, our whole motto is willing the good of another. So to take care of our clients, we're utilizing ETFs almost exclusively, you know, when it comes, as opposed to things like mutual funds and things, because we're able to get in and get out for a very, very, very just few dollars at a time.
Let's shift gears a bit now and talk about, you know, we like to always have some sort of a section around planning. And so what we're going to do now is talk about something super duper fun. Do you know what's the most fun thing in the world to talk about?
I don't know. Fishing?
No. Try again.
Curling.
Curling is awesome. Like, it's one of those sports that if you start watching it, you could just get mesmerized into it. And I like when the guys are going, hard, hard!
Okay, I didn't believe this because I thought it was one of those, like, little fads where it was sort of, it's not as cool as skiing. It's not, you know, adrenaline pumping, you know, as some of the other sports. And yet, people have piled on to the bandwagon of curling.
They pile on every Olympics.
Okay. And so I tested this theory because this year our boys, this is really like the first year the boys are really cognizant of like, okay, this is the Olympics and they're loving watching it, right? And so I turned on curling. I didn't tell them anything about it. Nothing. I just, right. they've been watching it sitting at the breakfast bar in the morning. I turn on the TV, which I normally have either Reuters or something on, but I let them watch, pulled them up to the breakfast bar and turned on the Olympics. And I just clicked on the previous night's primetime Olympics coverage and there was curling. And so I just put it on and I wanted to see what was going to happen.
Now, mind you, the children are 3 and 6.
Yeah. So 3 and 6 and didn't say anything. And I just put it on. And don't you know, they were mesmerized.
Yeah.
They were mesmerized. And both of them are going, harder, harder. It's almost there. It's almost there. I couldn't believe it. How into it they were.
It puts you into a trance.
I think so.
It's...
So we've tested that theory.
It's awesome. I like the guys like, hard, hard, hard.
Yeah.
He's down. He's down.
Yeah, but that's not what this topic is about.
No. I wish that this was quite as cool as curling. Although this topic is, curling is one of the few sports you can still play while receiving this.
Ooh.
We're talking Social Trivia? Security. We're talking Social Security. No, you know, we always have a planning section, and we're going to talk a little bit about Social Security. And we don't talk too much about Social Security on the show because it's, you know, one of the things that I'm a believer in is that you should plan your retirement as if Social Security doesn't exist. And if you are in a situation in life where you can live and Social Security is just gravy, great. Now, obviously, not everybody is there, and some people are you know, Social Security is not only their main source of income, but their only source of income, and I fully recognize that. So Social Security plays a very important part in planning for retirement. So I think it's important for people to understand really some of the things about it, and there were some changes in 2018. So I think it's good to review some of the changes in 2018. So a recent article on AARP went through some of the changes for 2018 for Social Security. And the first one that talks about is a benefits jump. So Social Security had a benefits jump where the Social Security recipients get a 2% cost of living adjustment called a COLA. Funny that a COLA is a cost of living adjustment, but if you drink too much of it, it'll kill you. But anyway, and so their monthly benefit increase had the largest increase since 2012. The average recipient will receive $1,404 a month, up from $1,377. Now, that's excellent, right? So you had Social Security going up, what is that, $27 a month. Now, I got to tell you, people are excited about that. They're fired up. Well, here's the problem with this, is that the Social Security monthly premium, it did remain at $134 a month. And the Part B deductible is $183. But think about this for a minute. Your income is $1,300 a month. Your Medicare Part B is $134, and that's only 80/20. So what my point here is that, as you know, a lot of people are like, I can't wait to get on Medicare. Well, Medicare, you know, when you think about it, it's $1,400 a month for your Social Security, but your Medicare eats up 10% of that right off the top. And that's only 80/20 coverage, and it doesn't have the prescription drug coverage, right? So while I think that the biggest fear I think most people have in retirement is running out of money and not having enough money. And if you believe that the problem's going to be solved because I'm getting Medicare Part B, you're wrong. And so I think that one of the things that people tend to not plan for effectively is the high cost of healthcare as they get older. Now, we know that the Affordable Care Act fixed all of those problems, right?
Sure.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's just something to consider and just think about that. So that was one of the changes for 2018. Another change.
Higher tax cap.
Yeah. So what does that mean? What does that mean?
Workers contribute 6.2% of their earnings to Social Security up to an income of $127,200. But in 2018, that ceiling rises to $128,700.
Yeah. So that means that there's more money going into the pool. That's really what that means. Mm-hmm. So for high income earners, they're defined as high income earners. They don't pay any Social Security tax after $128,700. One of the things that many, many people in Congress have spoken about is getting rid of this cap completely. So the way it works now is if you pay, let's say you make $400,000 a year, you're going to pay 6.2% of your first $128,000. Your additional $280,000 that you make, you don't pay any tax. You don't pay any of that 6.2% Social Security tax. Now, what's the pros and cons of this? Well, the benefit of this, you know, Social Security has a ceiling, right? There's a limit on how much you can make in Social Security. And so if they tax those higher income earners for the entire amount, then they're not going to receive any reward for putting it in, right? Social Security is not a right. Social Security, in my mind, is not an entitlement program because it's something that you pay into all your life. And the idea is that you pay into it all your life and then you get something back at the end. By having a stopping point, a ceiling, if you will, at a certain point, you ensure that the many aren't completely paying for the few, and that the cap, keeps everybody kind of on a level playing field. So I can understand that. I can also understand that, you know, why do we shut it off? Because the system itself is broken, and over time is going to run out of money if something doesn't change. So, you know, it's something to consider. And that change affected 12 million out of the 175 million workers who pay into Social Security. So, you know, it affected a little less than 10% of the people that made over 128,000. But it definitely, you know, if that number goes up, if I see any major changes in Social Security, that's what I see changing first, is that I see that they're going to add that that they're going to keep raising that ceiling at an astronomical rate, and in fact, eventually just get rid of it completely.
Yeah, I mean, the sky's the limit. And you can go to infinity.
And I got to tell you, I have a problem with that. I do. I have a big problem with that. And my big problem with that, now, let me rephrase that. I wouldn't have a problem with it if
it wasn't capped on the other
side. If you weren't capped on the other side. If you weren't capped on the withdrawal, I'm okay with it. But since you're capped on the withdrawal, I got a problem. So if they find a way to figure that part out, I'm all for it. Whatever we need to do to keep the system running. Another one.
Especially since the next part is that we'll be working longer.
Yeah. So the next one is that full retirement age gets older. So what this means is that for people born in 1956, the full retirement age, meaning when you can get full benefits, climbs to 66 years old and 4 months. Now that's up from 66 years old and 2 months for those born in 1955. Full retirement is going to increase 2 months every year until it reaches age 67 for everybody born in 1960 or later. So when Social Security first started, one of the things to consider is that the average lifespan of people was about 65 years old, and they started receiving benefits at age 62. Well, now that the average lifespan is over 78, the system is not designed to pay people as long as it's paying them. That's what's putting the strain on the system. So you've got choices. You can take a smaller benefit.
I think you have it. Can I interrupt you for just a second? Because I think there's a problem on the far end where people are living longer.
Yep.
But there's also less people in the workforce because people are having less children. Also,
that's a huge part of it. There's less people that are in the workforce that are filling it. And that being the other piece
is... Not to mention the labor force participation rate.
That's exactly right. Our labor force participation rate, which most people don't realize, is the lowest it's been since Carter was in office. How many times have you heard something good about when Carter was in office? Right? And so I think that is something that scares a lot of people, because as retirement ages get older and older, you know, I'm not quite yet 40, and the retirement age when I'm in that will probably be 72 to 74 is my guess. It'll be in there as they continue to push it higher. Maximum benefits are rising. So those earning at full retirement age, the maximum payout has increased to $27.88 a month, or $33,000 a year. That's up from $26.87, which was $32,200 a year. So maximum benefits, the most you can get in Social Security is $33,456. This is why it can't be your only plan for retirement. If you're used to making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year and you don't have a plan for retirement and you say, oh, I'm just going to live on Social Security, the absolute maximum payout is $33,456 a year, which is probably going to be lowering most people's standard of living. So without a solid...
And people may have to move. Because there are certain parts of the country where you just can't survive on that.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, here in Houston, Texas, our taxes are almost a third of that, right? Just our property taxes alone. People say, well, your house is paid off. Well, your taxes never go down. So you got to have a good plan to understand how to handle when these things happen. For our final segment of the week, we always tend to look at oil, and we look at energy, and we look at some of the things that are happening around the world in, you know, the world of power. And you found an interesting article that you thought would be worth, you know, just kind of peeling the onion back a little bit and talking about, and it was on Bloomberg.com. So why don't you dive us in?
Yeah, on Bloomberg.com, I found an article about Saudi Arabia, who we all know is the world's biggest oil exporter. They are conducting bids. They went out for bid to build two nuclear power plants.
Which is interesting that Saudi Arabia, when you think Saudi Arabia, you think oil, right?
Oil there's king,
you think oil and princes.
Yeah.
There's,
I mean, you've been there and we've been to Abu Dhabi and we've been to Dubai and, you know, different places in the UAE. Like, everything revolves around turning oil into dollars to build magnificent structures.
Right.
So
my favorite thing, by the way, about Saudi Arabia, I'm sorry to interrupt you,
that?
Is that there's a gigantic building in Riyadh. It's a beautiful building. The top of it just looks like a big bagel cutter.
Really?
Yeah, it's got like a handle. You know, like those bagel cutters that's got the handle and you push the thing down.
And it slices the bagel in half?
It slices the bagel. It looks just like a bagel cutter. So knowing me, I looked at it and I just got hungry. I mean, I just wanted an everything bagel with sausage and an egg, and then I remembered, I can't get sausage!
No, can't get sausage.
Oh.
Yeah, but, you know, we've been to all, you know, a lot of those places, and, I mean, we were at the top of the Burj Khalifa, which was super awesome.
Right.
Yeah, that was fantastic. But the kingdom has received requests from five different bidders. So check this out.
What China, are the five bidders?
China.
Okay.
France,
obviously.
U.S., South Korea, and Russia.
Okay, all right. I mean, wait, time out. This sounds like an Olympic medal race. China, France, the U.S., South Korea, and Russia.
That's right.
Well, yep. You got to eliminate South Korea right off the top. They're not going to do any deal with Saudi Arabia. It's just not going to happen. We don't give them enough stuff back. It's going to come down to us or Russia. I'm picking Russia.
I don't know. I mean, these
oh, are wait, the bitters. Chernobyl. Chernobyl. We should win.
There was that. The five bidders would be responsible for engineering, procurement, and construction. And they're looking at building two nuclear power plants. And what I thought was really interesting was that the reason they're looking to do that is because they want to diversify their economy and lessen their dependence on oil sales.
Well, I mean, oil sales is its big, I mean, that's, what else is there?
What else is there? What right? else do you know? What else is included in their GDP? Do you even know off the top of your head?
I don't. I've never looked that up. It may be worth looking up. But oil is the lion's share of their GDP, I would imagine, as far as the industry and energy industry. But they need to be able to sell it, and the more that they use inside, the less that they can. That they can export and sell off. So that could be part of it as well, is that, hey, listen, we need to be able to sell more of this off. There are some countries in the Middle East that, like, Dubai produces no oil, right? The United Arab Emirates, the UAE, there's some oil that comes out of the UAE, but Dubai, the gigantic city, has none. It's a financial center. So they've found a way to transform their economy around more finances and trading and investing and real estate than they have around the oil piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just looked up real fast. 90% of exports out of Saudi Arabia is petroleum and petroleum products.
Yeah.
So 90% of their economy, their GDP is made up of essentially the oil.
So. Right. So they want to lessen that dependence, which mm-hmm. if you think about it, I mean, it really is... As the world's population is shifting towards, you know, more climate friendly concepts, oil's getting a worse and worse name. And for Saudi Arabia, you've got to think long term. What else can we do if this dries up?
Well, and one thing I find slightly humorous about this, I mean, I worked in nuclear area for a good long while, so that's not the humorous part to me. But it says that they want to meet a larger share of their energy needs from renewables such as solar power. And whenever I think of solar power, oh. I always go back to the deck that we built back in at our house in Pittsburgh.
Oh yeah, we put up this gigantic deck, and we're like, we'll just light it with solar lights.
Yeah, and. It had this like tiny little light. And I just remember one night we were sitting out there and I was just like, the world cannot be powered on solar alone. Like, no. It's just, you know, it's not that it can't be, you know, it can't be used, but like if you look at how much power the demand for power around the world, it just cannot be powered by the sun. It cannot be satisfied by the sun. So I just thought that was slightly humorous.
Yeah, that's going to be a little much. I mean, if anybody can do it and has space, it's Saudi, right? If anybody has the space to create farms, terra acreage, if you will, of solar, it would be Saudi. Mm-hmm. But
it's definitely viable, but to support an entire nation on the sun is...
Sure.
Just mathematically.
But I think what's more striking is that Saudi Arabia is looking to lessen its dependence on oil.
Mm-hmm.
That is a paradigm shift that could be, and I'm just calling it could be, a crack. It's a crack, if you will, in the armor of big oil. Big oil is a big player, and Saudi Arabia is the biggest of the big players in oil. Mm-hmm. And that crack in the armor is important, and it's something to not take lightly.
Yeah, and you know, a couple segments ago, we had talked about in our education segment for this week, we talked about the U.S. dollar and how all right. these things are bought, especially oil, is bought in U.S. dollars. And so, do you think, like, what do you think about this? Do you think that, you know, they how does that affect their economy? How does it affect the world economy? What does it look like for us in Houston that, you know, our Houston economy is majorly driven by the oil industry?
Well, I think it's something that everybody realizes that these, what's the word I want to use? Fossil fuel technology, fossil fuel energy it's going away slowly. And it's going to go away very slowly, frankly, because there's a lot of money behind it. But oil, you know, oil as of right now is trading at $62.30 a barrel for the next front month contract. And at $62 a barrel, the companies that are pumping that oil out of the ground are making money, and they're making a lot of money because
the forecast is projected to increase the demand for oil next year by a lot.
And they were making money at $45 a barrel. Right? If they're making money at $45 a barrel, they're making money hand over fist at 60 some dollars a barrel. Mm-hmm. But every recession, just about without fail, every recession is marked by increased energy cost. Right? Almost every recession is marked by started with increased energy cost.
The last 10 of 11, I think we talked about that last week.
Yeah. Right? And just in the last year, in less than a year, oil's gone up 50%. I mean, in just a year, if I just have, you know, one year's price up, 1 year ago, you know, oil was as low as $42 a barrel. It got as high as $66 a barrel. That's a 50% increase in the price. And a 50% increase in the price of anything is impressive, right? But that 50% increase in the price of the raw material is going to eventually, right? If the raw material costs more, then everything else is going to get more expensive. And if we continue to go, and I genuinely believe that there's room for oil to go to 80, I think eventually we can get to 80. And if we do get to 80, you're going to start to see that chink in the armor, if you will, of the economy. And that's really where most of the really smart people that I've respected for a long time and that I've heard have said that we're about 2019 is really the year that they expect most of the stuff to kind of all come together. Oil will have peaked, technology will kind of have run out, and a lot of people are really predicting 2019 is that final run. So we'll see if that happens. I don't know, and I'm not trying to be a predictor, but it is quite telling when you look at, you know, somebody like Saudi Arabia saying, maybe we should look at other things other than the oil.
And they're not throwing up a reactor next year. They're looking at completing this project by 2027.
Right, yeah. I mean, they got some time to do it. But I also look at it like this. McDonald's sells salads and chicken and fish, but they're never going to get out of the hamburger business, right? McDonald's sells chicken and fish and salads and milkshakes, but they're never going to get out of the hamburger business. Saudi may diversify its economy to lessen its dependence on oil sales, but it's never going to get out of the hamburger business. It's never going to get out of the business of fossil fuels as its main economic engine and driving its overall revenue stream. That's what I believe. For what it's worth. So what does that mean for us as investors? I think what it means for us as investors is just keep your eye. I mean, these are the kind of stories that may mean something, but may not mean something right now. But it certainly is something for us to keep our eye on and to keep a clean ear to the ground. And what I say every day is make sure you have a plan. So that's all the time we have for this week. Until next week, always remember, if there's anything we can do for you, please feel free to reach out. You can give us an email, chuck@iiefinancial.com, annie@iiefinancial.com, either one of us, or just go to the website and fill out a contact us, and we will get back to you as soon as we can. Annie, any parting words of wisdom?
No, just enjoying the Olympics, and we'll see you next week.
All right, see you next week. Thanks, everybody.
IIE Financial is an investment advisor representative with Symphony Financial, a registered investment advisor. Charles Fulkerson is an investment advisor representative with IIE Financial and Symphony Financial, LTD Co. Annie Fulkerson is not registered nor affiliated with Symphony Financial. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Symphony Financial. The topics discussed and opinions given are not intended to address the specific needs of any listener. IIE Financial does not offer legal or tax advice. Listeners are encouraged to discuss their financial needs with the appropriate professional regarding your individual circumstance.